the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, you're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Alejandro Mendoza is an adjunct instructor of business analytics and accounting, teaching both graduate and undergraduate students at GU. Originally from Mexico City, he speaks of a career of solving unstructured problems, providing a wide range of opportunities that ultimately led him to the Pacific Northwest via Chicago.
What's happening, brother? I can hear you loud and clear, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the world-famous podcast you got going on here.
Yeah, indeed. We've yet to monetize anything on the pod, but maybe someday. Who knows? Who knows? But
Well, I can tell you this, right? I'm going to send this to my mom afterwards, and I'm sure she'll listen to it a few times and send it to all her friends. So hopefully this will set some new records.
Grassroots, baby. That's what we need right there from the bottom up. Well, cool, man. Well, this is... It's an honor. I always like hanging out with you. And it wasn't too long ago we were hanging out and I learned a little more about your story and what brought you to Gonzaga. And I was like, oh, gotta have this guy on the pod. So take me back to the humble beginnings, sir. I think you told me I always viewed you as a Chicago guy, but you informed me that no, the first dozen years of your life, you were growing up in Mexico City. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was born and raised for, 12 maybe years old in just north of Mexico City, a town called San Luis Potosí, Mexico. Born there, went to school there. And then my parents decided to immigrate to Chicago, and I actually started the fifth grade in Chicago, and I didn't know any English whatsoever. And there was no English as a second language, so you kind of just had to figure it out. And in retrospect, I think that that experience has really made me who I am today, because I'm very comfortable in like really uncomfortable situations. I'm like, I'll just figure it out and work through it. And I think having that in my background has really prepared me to be who I am today. And I was in Chicago for, majority of my adult life. And up until 3 years ago, I moved here to the Spokane, Coeur d'Alene area, and I've been here ever since.
In your... Do you have like an English workbook at home? You said there was no ESL service. Are they just popping you in everyone's class and you're just trying to keep your head above water, or any English classes before down in Mexico?
There was no English classes before down in Mexico whatsoever.
Okay.
And, you know, when I started the fifth grade here, there were no Spanish books, or there was no Duolingo. There was none of the modern conveniences that we have today. And even watching TV at home, there was, I didn't have the ability to translate the shows into Spanish like we have today. So I grew up watching The Brady Bunch, and I grew up watching some of those shows that, you know, folks our age grew up watching. And that's how I started picking up language and just seeing how facial expressions and body movement, that I started correlating words. And that's how I started picking up the language.
Did you guys live in a Spanish-speaking community in Chicago? Was there like a neighborhood that was?
We always lived close to family. That's one of the things that my parents did. Is, you know, a few houses down were one aunt, a few other houses down were another uncle, and so on. So I was able to hang out with them and speak Spanish. But I got to a point where, I think it was my uncle who's like, we're just going to start talking in English and you're going to have to figure it out. And I vividly remember this. this fond memory where, you know, we would go to Sears when Sears stores used to be around. There was a flagship store in Chicago, and they had a candy stand. And my uncle's like, you can have all the candy you want as long as you order it in English.
Incentives, motivations, man.
Yeah.
So you got, you were, you gained a ton of weight, but you had great English. So that,
yeah.
So, and it's funny. I mean, you've told me before there are, I don't want to use the word gaps, but you're like, I know the alphabet in Spanish. I really never had to sit down and learn in tune or whatever letter is called. And obviously, you know them now, but what we would think of like singing the ABCs, right? And you're just like, well, that was kind of before my time here. So at what point do you think you were fluent? Were you able to, is it like 2 years, high school? What are we talking about?
That's a good question. So I think I was able to speak the language definitely by, you know, by eighth grade, right? I was able to communicate. And just get by, right? I certainly wasn't making very articulate points in English. I didn't have an expansive vocabulary. So I definitely progressed significantly in high school. College, I got even better. But at college, I faced a new challenge, which was writing.
Yeah.
For... you know, up until that point, it was, can I communicate effectively? And in college, I had one professor who's like, listen, you're not going to pass my class unless you improve your writing. I'm like, oh my gosh, how do I get better at writing? So that kicked off another effort of just trying to get better at writing and doing everything I possibly could to get better at writing. And now I've added two elements that I was trying to master, right? Communicate effectively in a verbal way and writing.
And that's a challenge even for English as a first language students. It depends somewhat, I think, on the high school background, but when you come to a college like Gonzaga and you went to what I imagine is a similar school, I'm not too familiar. We'll talk about where you went in a sec, but it's a new level. Right. And it's
right.
Demanding. And that's we've mentioned on this pod before, a differentiator for sure. Our students from students that are in non-liberal arts institutions. But you stuck around Chicago for college. And tell me about the school you went to, a little bit about it.
Yeah. So that was a very difficult decision about where to go to school, because my passion was to be a pilot.
Oh, okay.
Right. And I was accepted into a few schools that had flight programs, but they would have required me to move away from home. And, you know, my family wasn't supportive, right? We come from Mexico, and that just was not normal. So I had to pivot. Right. Where I'm like, OK, well, what do I do now? Right. I had been accepted to two schools with flight programs, one in Florida, one in Southern Illinois. I was a good student, so I had scholarships, but it just wasn't enough. So I had two hurdles. One is I had to convince my parents. And the second is, how can I afford this?
And are you were first generation college?
Yes. Yeah. I was first generation. So I took a long, hard look, and my dad's like, hey, there's plenty of good schools here, and it's going to be a challenge either way. Why not just stick around here? And he kind of was pretty firm about that. So one of my cousins, Maria, she was attending a local private school in the Chicagoland area. At that point, it was called Rosary College. It is now called Dominican University. And I went there and I just absolutely fell in love with the campus, the small class sizes, the attention that the professors, dedicated to all the students. That was my pivot away from, I didn't give up on flight, but that was the first pivot away from becoming a pilot.
I'm trying to look at some of the numbers here. Undergrads about 2,200 right now, and about 1,000 grads in Dominican. So pretty small. You're known, everybody. Were there any Dominicans as instructors?
Yes, I had one sister. I don't remember her name. And I believe it was a theology course I took with her. And it was one of the most fascinating classes I had at Dominican.
Geology.
Theology.
Theology. Gotcha. That makes a little more sense, right? Okay. Very cool. Now, you're a man of a lot of hobbies, interests, I should say, not hobbies. Have you made any progress on your pilot's license?
You know, I have thought about it over the years to get back at it. And now that I've moved here to the Coeur d'Alene, Spokane area, there is the local airport that has flying lessons. But it's one of those things where, oh my gosh, do I want to invest my time in learning how to fly? Or would I rather be mountain biking?
Choices. Choices.
Yeah. So it's still in the back of my mind to one day get my license. But as of now, I'm just enjoying the great outdoors of the inland Northwest has to offer.
Yeah, that's awesome. So take me kind of back. College experience is good. You decide to major in what?
So I enrolled at Dominican University. But I did not give up the dream to do something within the aviation industry.
Okay.
So I enrolled and decided that I had watched a video in high school. And at that point, the focus was on chemical engineering and how chemists were working on new products for airplanes. So that simple video from high school, I'm like, that's how I can still be involved in the aviation industry. That's how I can still be around airplanes. So I enrolled with a major of chemistry because I'm like, this is going to be my path to work on airplanes. And I only took one chemistry class in high school, or maybe two, I think. And there were great classes, but I didn't necessarily go into more advanced chemistry classes. So here I am, you know, first day of class into, the first course in the chemistry curriculum. And oh my gosh, was I in for a rude awakening. It was extremely difficult for me. I had to spend probably three or four times the amount of time in doing the homework and prepping for exams and, you know, taking notes because I was that far behind everyone else. And it was through that process that was really, really difficult that I met a professor, Dr. Faltnack, Dr. Robert Faltnack. And he just saw how hard I was working that he became my biggest cheerleader. I would take up hours of his time during office hours because I just wanted to get better and I knew that I could. And I still have, I think one of the exams that I got nearly a perfect score. And I was doing it right. I was on my way. I'm like, okay, I can do this. Right. I was building confidence that I could, but I was putting in so much work, so much more effort than all of my peers. And I'm like, well, what if I dedicate this, all this effort to maybe something that will come naturally to me? And I didn't know what it was, but I just kept at it. I kept at it. And I think it was sophomore year where I started taking more of the electives. And I took accounting 260. It's the equivalent at GU. It came natural to me. And one of my mentors, he's like, well, why don't you switch to accounting? why don't you switch, right? Because that's another way you can still be in the aviation industry. I'm like, yeah, but I won't be near the airplanes. I'll just see the numbers going by. So it took a lot of convincing. And at that point in my academic career, Dr. Faltnik was my advisor. And I just had an open conversation with him and confided in him about my struggles and where I wanted to go. He's the one that nudged me to say, listen, I think if that you'll be successful here, but you're going to have to work extra hard. And if that's something that's interest to you and that comes natural to you, go explore that. You can always come back and do this. And I never look back.
Are you still in contact with that professor?
You know, I tried looking him up, about 10 years ago. I'm sure he has since retired, because he has just such a tremendous impact on my life. It's one of those first mentorship experiences and friendships that I formed that really also shaped into who I am today. I remember going into his office during office hours, and he would always have the door open for me, whether it was to talk about chemistry or not chemistry, or just to talk about something random. He was always there. He was always willing to listen, willing to be engageful. And he never said, hey, I'm busy. He never said, hey, come back later. He always made time. He was also one of the professors that, I think it was in my junior year. He invited some of his best students to dinner at his home with his wife. He was the professor that took me out to celebrate when I finally received my green card. He was the professor who wrote an awesome letter of recommendation to the immigration officer to get my green card. So I tried looking him up to just give him the thanks again. I even went to Dominican University and I'm like, if I give you a letter, can you deliver it to him? I can't remember if I did or if I didn't, but I went that far.
And I'm guessing no response.
No response. Yeah.
We'll see what the Google says about him. You talking about that resonates with me in a way that having witnessed you as an adjunct here, engaging the students, being available for the students, and being a mentor for the students in a thoughtful way. I certainly noticed it, but it's good to know where some of that stems from, your experience. And it certainly adds value to what we try to do here. And paying it forward, that's just awesome. And that's what you hope, the 25 that you mentor each year go forward and do. So that's pretty incredible. So you're a glutton for punishment. You go over, you're doing accounting. And I think eventually you get a graduate degree. Were you caught up by the 150 rule? Is that the...
I was caught by the 150 rule, yes. Okay.
Caught by the 150. So you get your... Maybe smaller school doesn't offer a MAC or MBA with a concentration in accounting. Might be something like that.
Yeah.
And then you just join the Chicago market. You're a Chicago guy at this point. Top to bottom.
Yeah. So that's also an interesting story about how I joined the Chicago market, because I had to pay my own way through school. I had to work. I had to work quite a bit to be able to contribute to my education and help out my parents who were both working factory jobs. So I didn't spend a whole lot of time on campus. So I missed all the campus opportunities to network, do interviews, do interview preps, meet with recruiters. I missed all of that. And from the time I was in high school and all through college, I worked for this Italian family who I'm still friends with. And he sat me down. Chris is his name. He sat me down right before the fall semester started of my final year of college. And he's like, listen, I've seen you grow up, but I think you're destined for greater things. And the minute you receive that diploma, your employment here will cease. And you can use all the resources that I have here to effectively try to secure your next job. And he gave me a list. He's like, I want you to end up in one of the accounting firms, one of the major accounting firms. And I was 17, 18 years old at that point, right? So that was devastating. I'm like, I've known him for a long time, all through high school, college, right? That was a big moment in my life. Where I'm like, well, what do you mean? And he's like, you're going to find something better. And if you stay here, I'm going to hold you back. You have to go and find something better. And, you know, he taught me a lot of great life skills that I still use to this day. So he's like, you have a whole academic year to figure this out. So I scratch my head. I'm like, well, what am I going to do now? Like, right. This is family. This is like, you know, I saw his kids grow up, would hang out with his grandparents or his parents. They always felt like my grandparents. I knew his nieces, his nephews, and it was a huge deal for me. So he gave me the to-do list. He's like, here's all the major accounting firms in Chicago and Crane Chicago Business published, you know, the firms, their addresses, and the names of all the managing directors. So because I was always working, I missed all of the opportunities to do practice interviews. I missed all the meeting the recruiters. So I did what he taught me to do, which was just to pick up the phone and make phone calls. And I was able to get a hold of most of the managing directors of each of the offices. And once I had them on the phone, I knew that if I told them my story, that, you know, hopefully I would get invited for an interview. And sure enough, I did. And I actually started my career at Arthur Andersen as a result of one of those phone calls that I got invited in for an interview.
And that's the world headquarters at the time, wasn't it? Chicago, where it was based out of?
Probably. Yes, it was. Yeah.
What did this gentleman do for his own work? Was he a business guy? Was he a...
When I met him, he had just started an insurance agency. Oh. And I worked in helping him build the insurance agency. I was 15, 16 years old, right? I didn't know what I was doing. But it gave me something to do. And my parents were elated because they're like, hey, he's staying busy and he's not out, you know, doing things with his friends. He's out learning something.
Yeah.
So to this day, all the skills that I learned while working for him, I there's not a day that goes by that I don't use something that I learned from that time.
Interesting. I'm going to go jump back a little bit. You mentioned your green card, getting your green card. And my thought was, you know more about, just because of the test you had to take, right? You know, like a green card test, more and more about some of the, I don't know if it's civics or history or all of the above, than 99% of Americans. And you're a full citizen now.
I am.
Awesome. So when you go to the airport and land in Charles de Gaulle, you get flipped off too. So that's good to know. That's good to know. Well, welcome. Welcome to the big time. That's awesome. So you start out at Andersen, and I'm guessing, given the time frame, they might have been pretty short-lived, right? Because they're kind of, I'm guessing this is around 2000, 2001, and things are, Enron and some other things are going to start happening here pretty quick.
Yeah, it was very short-lived. I think it was 18 months, maybe 2 years. Everyone sort of started moving to different firms, and I'm like, well, what if I do something different? What if I follow this passion that I had started, just this curiosity thing with this, I'm like, what happens with all these transactions? Where do they go? And I'm like, yeah, I can certainly continue down the audit path and doing the work. I was on working on a big audit at that point, and the entire team moved to another firm. And I'm like, but I'm always going to be curious if I didn't chase this thing that I was really interested in that I couldn't really describe back then. I'm like, I'm more interested in this other thing, this data, this transactions. So I use effectively the collapse of Arthur Anderson to really pivot my career into what I really just felt fascinated with.
In my opinion, and I'm sure opinions will vary on this, but looking at what was the big five back then, Anderson, in fact, at least my perception at the time, was, if not the best, one of the top two. And they were very forward thinking on a lot of things. They purchased an old college somewhere in the Chicagoland area. I used it as a training center. I don't know if you ever got the opportunity to go out there.
I did. It's a beautiful campus.
Now, we're 25 years later, other firms are starting to do that as well. What was it like being in the headquarters, like when the news hits, or how does that work? Like, are your mentors in the firm saying, hey, polish up your CV? Hey, I'm going over to KPMG. Do you want to come with me? What is that? What's that experience like? Or are you pretty much naive at that point as a first year staff?
Yeah, I was certainly very naive about how to handle the situation. However, you can't avoid going out for lunch, right? So I think it was 33 West Monroe. It was the building. And we would have to go up to the second floor, third floor to go up the escalators to get to the elevator and go up. So going out to lunch was quite the experience, because we would be on the escalator and you would see all the media out front. And you kind of just want to go and have lunch, right? You didn't necessarily, nothing prepared you for that at that point, right? There was no classes you could have taken of crisis management, or at least I didn't know that you could have taken a class around that. But it was pretty scary, right? You would go out for lunch every single day for weeks at a time, and the media was there. And I was so early on in my career that I hadn't, I had built friendships, but not necessarily to a point of saying I have a mentor. And I think that helped me to a certain extent, because I was able to pivot. I was able to pivot and not feel like, hey, I'm committed to this mentorship to keep going down a particular path.
Was there like a directive from above not to speak to any media? I mean,
there was. It was just a standard practice, sure. Which any firm, any company, anywhere has the same policy of, all media communications has to be handled by our communication department. So I got very good of saying no comment.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Not that you would have known anything anyway as a staff, but were you there was there an actual day when things just collapsed, or was it just kind of a slow bleeding death and you were gone before they? I'm told there's, well, I've heard there is still a firm. Now, the name, I think, has been licensed to Anderson, what was Anderson Tax, and then became Anderson. I've also heard that Arthur Anderson, the fifth or sixth, works at said Anderson. not as a CPA, but that these are all side points. And there's still a partnership in place, but was it just a slow and everyone's going, or, and did you get like a last day or the close is separate? What was the coup de grace?
I don't remember in great detail, but I believe I stepped away probably 6-8 months before the collapse of the firm.
So you were kind of out of there. Interesting.
I was out of there.
And so you said you were going to jump somewhere else. You went to a new path. What was the next step?
So the next step is, I knew that there was, I had become fascinated when I was doing audits, where we would bring in these IT auditors, and I would always ask, like, well, you know, can you explain to me a little bit more? They're like, no, it's too complicated. It's too complicated. Like, but how do you want me to sign off on work papers and be able to speak to a work that I don't understand? And that just never, like, felt good with me. I never felt comfortable with that. And every time I would ask deeper questions, like, it's too complicated. I don't have time. It's too complicated. I don't have time. And that for me created this fire in me to figure this out. What exactly is so complicated that they can't explain it to me? So as I started my career search, or my next move, I should say, I found this really odd job at this company where they needed help in analyzing IT financial contracts and the implication of those contracts, the financial implication of those contracts that it will have based on where that piece of software was installed on the mainframe. And give me a second. Let me get the dog settled, and I'll continue the story here. All right, you'll have to edit that out. So I knew that I had, accounting finance skills. And I had found this job that needed someone to understand the financial implications of making certain decisions. Those decisions were, what happens if we install certain software in certain parts of the mainframe? And I'm like, this sounds pretty cool. I never knew anything about, you know, software licensing agreements. I had heard about the mainframe. But never was involved on discussions at that level. So I'm like, I'm going to do this. I have no idea where this is going to lead me to, but I'm going to do it. So I did. My manager was Scott at that point, and it started working in the IT asset management area. And understanding everything, my first role was getting a handle on all the contracts and the location of all the mainframe software. Because they were trying to rationalize, they were ensuring that they didn't have any compliance issues. They were effectively trying to maximize the value of their licensing without necessarily breaking any terms and conditions of the contracts. And that was an amazing experience because I got to learn about the mainframe. I got to learn about the operations of an IT organization from a technical standpoint and also from a financial standpoint. Like, this is really cool. Then I started getting exposed more to just the overall IT asset management of all the assets that an organization has to have in place in order for it to function properly. Like, this is pretty cool. And then they hired an IT financial controller. And when he learned that I had an accounting finance background, I was moved under him. His name's Tony. I've lost touch with him. And he effectively says, listen, here are the two departments that have the largest budgets. You're their financial analyst now. So it was a really neat experience because I was able to learn about the infrastructure side of an IT organization.
servers, mainframes, networking, you name it, data center operations. At that point, it was about managing contracts for backup storage tapes, and headcount allocation and growth, and figuring out how do we do projections of how much hardware are we going to need or how much storage we're going to need. And you know, the my purview of doing financial analysis just continued to get bigger, and it was pretty cool. Then they're like, well, can you help out on the application side of the house and do financial analysis on software development that we're doing? Like, of course I would. So now I got a chance to learn about the application software. You know, whether it's to build an enhancement to an app, whether it was to build a new application, whether it's should we buy a new app or a new piece of software, renew the contract, build it inside internally, or should we, you know, sign another agreement, right? So it was really, really fascinating. So now at that point, I became familiar with everything to do with application, cost allocation, everything to do with the infrastructure and how it all came together through chargebacks for the business. Mike, this is really cool.
And you have no tech background up to this point, very little exposure. So you're learning on the fly. How are you picking up this knowledge?
So, you know, you go back to my chemistry days, I would spend so much extra time and effort just digging in. So I volunteered myself that anytime there was any sort of upgrade, the mainframe servers, anything related to data centers, I wanted to be on call. I wanted to go in. I wanted to go and help out. And it was through that way that I started forming relationships with the various owners of either the application or the owners of the infrastructure. And they would take me under the wing. They briefly started me how to started showing me how to code. And I was young, right? So I didn't necessarily learn to code at that point in my career. But it was it taught me the value of building relationships and going the extra mile. And nobody told me to volunteer. I wanted to volunteer. I wanted to be there. I wanted to be someone they called if they needed a software key. So I was the person they would call and be like, get the vendor on the phone. We need a new software key because it's not working. And a few times I did that. And I just felt part of a team. So that's how I slowly started picking up the technical skills. It's by building those friendships and those bonds.
You shared a story with me once, and I'm probably jumping ahead in your career trajectory here, that you were sent on assignment to Mexico City. And I think everyone in the room looked and said, oh, well, Alex speaks Spanish. And so you had to teach yourself Mexican Gap, pretty much generally accepted accounting principles or whatever the word is they use down there, the terminology. But similar, it sounds like, right? Self-starter, lifelong learner. And I don't want to get too far ahead, but elaborate a little bit on that process and what that was like, if you could.
Yeah, so after the insurance company, at that point in my career, data warehousing was starting to become a thing. Okay. So I made a move to learn all about data warehousing, still being a financial analyst. And the role you're referencing is sort of the next move after that, where I'm like, okay, now I learned about this particular database, this particular financial system. How do other databases or how do other financial systems work? And then what if there's multiple financial systems? How does everything come together? So I took a role. This is now two roles removed from the insurance company. I took a role at a manufacturing company called Navistar or International Harvester. And for me, it was kind of an emotional job because my grandfather in Mexico owned International Buses. So it was an amazing connection to the brand, to the company. And it was also an amazing experience for me for my career because I was able to learn about different financial systems, different databases, different ways that a global corporation brings all those numbers together. Right. And I'm not sure how, but I started getting put on a bunch of special assignments and I never asked any questions. I'm like, sure, I'll go do that project. So the project you're referencing about, I think I received a call from the CFO. They're like, Alex, I need you on a plane to Mexico on Monday. I'm like, well, that's kind of a problem. I'm like, well, what's the problem? Like, I don't have a passport. I'm like, okay, well, go the following Monday. And I never asked any questions. I never asked, you know, what's in it for me. I never asked, you know, tell me about the scope. They're like, we have every faith in you that you'll get down there and you'll figure it out. So what was the project? It was, they had kicked off a finance transformation and they were trying to consolidate everything to one global general ledger. And I actually just talked about this morning in a meeting in my current role, where they just assumed whoever was doing the data movement, that data is data is data, and they moved it from A to B. And they completely forgot to account for all the business rules, all the accounting rules that came along with just that data. So I quickly discovered that they had moved years of financial data without any consideration to the rules, the accounting rules that apply to that data, and nothing was taken in time, and they couldn't figure out why. So I was sent to Mexico City. I think I ended up spending a year there working on this project.
And did you have family still down there?
I was in Mexico City, and yes, my family was in San Luis, so they were north, and they were a little far. So it was scary, right? You hear of Mexico City, big city. I'm like, oh my gosh, what am I getting myself into? But I'm like, you know what? It'll be fine. I'll figure it out.
And you're by yourself down there. I mean, yeah, you're working with other team members, but you're not out of Chicago, right? You're the only Chicago guy down there.
I'm the only Chicago guy down there.
Now you're a foreigner again in your home. reverse roles of some sort. But yeah, go ahead.
Not only am I a foreigner, but now I didn't speak the accounting language. So every day for the first few weeks, I would go to my hotel and just learn about Mexican accounting standards. I still have the book somewhere. And finally, I was like, okay, I think I know what I'm doing, right? I think I know how I'm going to handle this. So the complexity in that data migration, it was that we had an account. It was a financial institution that a U.S. company owned operating in Mexico, and Mexico had very strict accounting regulations for financial institutions. So someone just thought that they were going to move one set of books, but it ended up being four different types of books that we had to effectively move data for. It was U.S. GAAP, statutory GAAP, U.S. statutory GAAP, Mexican GAAP, and Mexican statutory GAAP.
Well,
so when I was sent in to help out with whatever is going on with the data because it's not ticking and tying, what I really had to step into was a data puzzle that I had to pick apart because now all the data was all together and it didn't make any sense. So I had to find a way to, how do I strip this data to its raw state? And then how do I sprinkle in the various regulations and also account for foreign currency? In the U.S., up until that point, right, everything was transacted in U.S. dollars. But in this financial institution in Mexico was transacting in pesos or in other foreign currencies.
So the puzzle just got a little bit more complicated every month and every transaction that I was reconciling. But for me, it was a wonderful experience because I stepped into the unknown. I had to learn a new skill quickly. And I ultimately had to find my way out and saying, hey, this is the direction. And the finance transformation program was, in fact, being jeopardized because if we couldn't convert the books properly, there goes the transformation. So I spent almost a year doing this. And it was amazing. And I was doing it with Crystal Reports. I was doing it with an Access database because IT, like, what do you mean you need a database? So I'm like, I'm just going to use easy tools that I can stand up fairly quickly. And I found a way to effectively introduce automation to this process, but not just the automation of moving the data back and forth, but to effectively do validation of the data before it moved, while it was moving, and after it moved. Whereas before, they were just doing validations after it moved, and after it moved, so much time had gone by.
How did this experience, you know, segue into, you know, a lot of the stuff you're doing now? And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I'm sensing is, you know, you're coming from the accounting, finance background. There's a lot of data there, and slowly over time, right, there's more of an integration with some analytics tools. And today you're doing some very different stuff, somewhat still related, but I feel like your career path has been, it's a nice little microcosm of what we've seen in the accounting profession: more data, more tech all the time. Give me some of the couple more stepping stones and then kind of where you're at today.
Yeah, so it wasn't an easy journey by any means. I've had quite a few interventions from friends that, you know, were genuinely concerned that I was killing my career because I was going down a path that didn't exist. But I just had this feeling that there was something here. I couldn't explain it. The terms necessarily didn't exist. And for a long time, I just said, listen, I am analyzing the byproduct of transactions. And that byproduct is all this data that gets generated. And I'm sure I wasn't doing a very good job in explaining it, but I'm like, there's something here. So that experience in working with that finance transformation project, I'm like, okay, this is really interesting, right? The data movement is not just data movement. You can't just simply siphon data from point A and insert it in point B and think you're good. There's a lot of discipline and rigor that has to go into it. So from that project, I think once it was completed, the CIO of Navistar, you know, said, hey, you can choose any job you want. I don't have any more special projects. Choose any job you want, and we'll support you on it. And I'm like, okay, this is pretty cool. And he's like, take your time, right? Look throughout the company. And they wanted me to, they were effectively hoping that I would take on the role of effectively being groomed for the IT controllership, financial controllership. And I'm like, that would be cool, but that wasn't my passion, right? So they were a little disappointed that I didn't go down that path. And I ended up finding this very obscure job that had been open for 2 years. And it was in the parts business of Navistar. And I met with the director. I'm still friends with him. His name's Joel. He's now CEO of a company somewhere, I think in Minnesota. And I met with him and I said, Joel, what's going on? You have this job open. Can we talk about it? And he's like, listen, this is really simple. We have a business strategy that says, hey, we're going to
buy parts from our manufacturers, mark them up, and sell them. And he's like, I believe we can use data to help us improve our pricing, help us improve in how do we go to market. And I know we can do it. I don't know how, but I know we're going to need data. And that's the job. You kind of have to figure this out. And I remember going back to the CIO and I'm like, that's the job I want. And he's like, Alex, that's the job that's been open for 2 years. There's a reason why it's been open for 2 years. I'm like, there's a lot of value there that I think has gone unnoticed. And that's the job I want. So that's when I started making the pivot away from ERPs, away from applications, away from databases that were maintained by ERPs to support the ERPs. And that's where I fell in love with unstructured problem solving. Because all he said is, here's the vision, go figure it out. And I will buy you, I think he bought me a year of incubation period to figure it out. And you know, I started just by interviewing all sorts of folks throughout the organization. Like, you know, what does data mean to you? Right? And they're like,
Wow. Interesting. Yeah.
So it began this journey of really looking at what is data? Is data something that simply exists in a database and rows and columns or in a spreadsheet? Or is data something that exists in flyers that get submitted from dealerships to saying, hey, here's a flyer about somebody promoting X part at different prices? So I said, listen, let's tackle the low hanging fruit. And the low hanging fruit was addressing data that was in a database that nobody was looking at. So I put forth a proposal to effectively look at data that was in a database, that was in the data warehouse, that someone somewhere along the way decided to put it in the data warehouse, but nobody was looking at it. I'm like, I think there's value there. So they're like, here you go. Here's all the data. And it was hundreds of tables, hundreds, if not thousands, of columns. And I had to figure out, how do I assemble this, right? So this is my Apollo 13 moment where they come in and put everything on the table and they're like, here, figure it out.
Right.
So I figured it out. I figured out how to tell that story. I figured out through a lot of validation. I figured out through a lot of testing. One of the things that we didn't want to do is be confidently wrong. So I, being the auditor that I was, right, I'm like, I need to trace my transactions. I need to be able to explain and attest to how this transaction came to be. So I went and spent time at dealerships, at various dealerships throughout the country, and I asked questions. Tell me about how you sell. Tell me about how this gets processed. And then I went and talked to our purchasing department. Talk to me about the procurement of these pieces. Talk to me about how do we know this is right or wrong.
Did you, given that industry, which has had a business model that's been set for some time, when you're poking around, are you experiencing any resistance? Resistance to change? What do you want? This is how we do it. This is how the Navistar way is. Anything?
I did at times. And I learned a very valuable skill is be able to tell the story of what's the value proposition. Why are we doing this? And my Joel at that point, he's like, if anybody pushes back, just send them my way. And I'm like, I'm never going to do that because I want to be able to work through this on my own. I want to be able to have this skill in my repertoire of being able to explain the value proposition of why we're doing this.
Yeah, you hit two really good points. The unstructured problem solving, everyone struggles with that at first. I do sense with you, after you've done it a while, it's almost like, yeah, this is going to be awesome. It's like a challenge ready to go. But you've really illustrated what I think a lot of people don't realize about this attractive term, data analytics or business analytics, and the amount of, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out, right? You got to have your data has to be, I don't want to use the word clean, but has to be right on some level to get out of it that story that you want. And that involves sometimes a ton of time digging into mundane, boring, tedious spreadsheets, whatever the data is. So, or however it's stored. That's fascinating. I want to jump a little bit ahead here. You move out to Spokane. Let's talk about why you moved out to Spokane and how you got connected with Gonzaga.
Yeah. So one last piece before I move on to my story or to the second question, right? But yeah, the thing about data is everyone just says, well, I have data, I can use it. And everyone always forgets to say, well, how did that get collected? How did that get in there, right? What are the assumptions of that data that went into it? And through my professional work experience and working on these unstructured problem solving, I didn't ever want to show up to a presentation and have my data being questioned. So I always did, I went above and beyond and doing the due diligence of how do I ensure that the data is right? Because I knew that we were going to make some big, big decisions that were going to impact the business. So to answer your question about, you know, how did I end up in the Spokane, Coeur d'Alene area in Gonzaga? I love the outdoors. I love the garden. I love to mountain bike. I love to ski. And when the pandemic hit, I sort of did an assessment of my life and how many days I was spending traveling to do mountain biking, to do skiing, right? So I got very analytical. And I came to realize, well, oh my gosh, I'm hardly at home. Why am I paying for a home in Chicago? I really should be moving. Then the pandemic hit. Okay, great. So the first chance I had, I flew out to, I think it was Salt Lake City. Really enjoyed an area, put money down on a home there. And as lumber prices continue to climb, I received a call from the builder that if I wanted to still buy the house, the price was going to go up significantly, and I had 2 weeks to make a decision. So I went back to my roots, and I did geospatial analysis and collected data, and I said, well, where's there an airport? Where's there good skiing? Where's there a lake? And I started quickly ruling out places that didn't meet their criteria because of the radius to be able to travel to an airport. And I think it was between here in this area and Montana. Whitefish, Glacier, that Glacier area there that has an airport, right? It meets the criteria. And the only reason I didn't end up in Montana is because the realtor that was going to be showing us around, I think she was getting married that weekend that I had free to be able to come and explore the area. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to come to Spokane, Coeur d'Alene area. Never been up here. Couldn't even pronounce Coeur d'Alene. And it just felt like home. You know, with the trees, the mountains, the fog, it really felt like home. And the last day that I was here, I just fell in love with the area that I decided to make an offer on a land, on a parcel of land, and canceled the deal in Salt Lake City.
Wow.
Yeah. So data is what was able to get me here to the area.
Yeah. And then you reached out to us at one point. I can't recall if it was me or Dean Anderson.
Yeah. So once I was here, I was telling my now wife that I wanted to get back to teaching because I really enjoyed it. I was teaching at Wright College, which is City College of Chicago for, gosh, over 10 years, if not more than 10 years. And I had to stop because I had a job that required me to travel quite a bit. So when I came here, I wasn't traveling. I had the time again. And I'm like, I want to get back into the classroom. And I knew of Gonzaga because they always have a great basketball team. I didn't know about John Paxson at that point with the Bulls and growing up in Chicago, that he was a former SAG. So I'm like, okay, I think I know what I want to do. And I didn't know anyone here. I didn't know. I didn't have a single contact at Gonzaga. I didn't have a single contact in the area, period. So it began the journey of drafting an email. And it took me probably the better part of 2 weeks to draft an email that I thought was compelling, that I thought told a story that I thought would cause a reaction on the other side, which is what I wanted, right? I wanted to get a phone call back. It was a cold email, if you will. Lots of edits. Lots of time went into that single email. And I finally had it ready. And I told my now wife, I'm like, okay, I'm going to schedule it at a certain time because I wanted to be at the top of the inbox instead of at the bottom and just be caught up. So I think I scheduled the email to be sent out on a Monday and be delivered by, I don't know, 6 a.m. And to my surprise, I think it was by 7, I had a response, which I was shocked. And I think 2 days later, you and I got connected, and that was 3 years ago.
Yeah, I'm trying to pull up the email now. I can't quite find the full chain, but I will at some point here. Actually, I do. I just found it. I just and I won't share with the group. But yeah, I'm glad I still have it still with your CV and everything. And you know, with your experience, and it was a no brainer on our end, particularly after I met you. And I can't emphasize enough how much you've been an instrumental part in the launch and building of our new Masters in Business Analytics. You know, a lot of small schools like Gonzaga, and despite the success of the basketball program, I think people don't quite realize that resources are very limited, and you don't just go to the provost office and say, I got a good idea. It's got to be proven first before they give you resources. And so a lot of that's done with professionals like you, adjuncts, that can come in and help us and bring expertise and really what's the most current. You know, like you have your class emerging issues, which is really popular, but the most current practices. So it's been an absolute pleasure on our side of the table. I want to be respectful of your time, and so I'm going to close with two questions. First, all right, would be a quick and easy one. Now, you worked at Navistar, which was International Harvester. Were there any Scouts or Scout 2s available to drive the old truck? I don't know if you're familiar with that. Those are magical.
So before I left Navistar, I contemplated going to the CEO and pitching the idea that we need to bring back the Scout.
Yes.
Because it was a great truck. And it is still one of my dreams to own a Scout. They're really expensive now to get one restored. But it's still on my bucket list to own a Scout. And no, there were no Scouts. I think there was one in the museum that the campus had, as you walk into the building. I think there was a Scout there. Mm-hmm. And now, ironically enough, years later, the Scout is coming back.
I think I heard or saw something about where they were. I don't know if it's some company bought the rights, maybe Volkswagen or something like that. And correct me if I'm wrong, are they going to do an EV model of that? That would be my dream, have an EV Scout to cruise around in.
That is what I understand, that it's going to be an EV Scout. And I can't wait, because I think it's my grandfather owned a Scout, and I've always wanted to own a Scout, and I now hope to hopefully own a Scout here soon.
As long as they keep the same shape body on it. I don't want them to try to leverage the brand equity of the Scout and just basically deliver another Bronco or something like that. We need the actual. actual car or truck, I should say. Now you're an adjunct. You're teaching for us pretty much every semester. I don't know when you sleep, to be honest. working closely with a lot of students a lot of the time. What's some of the advice you'd give to our newly minted graduates as they embark on a career based on, you know, your tremendous journey?
Yeah, I think I would echo the advice that the Dr. Faltnik gave me when I received my diploma. He gave me a big hug after the ceremony, and I actually still have the picture. And he whispered in my ear that learning doesn't stop because you're out of the classroom. And so it just, learning is very different. I think once you're out of in the real world, right, you have to be in charge of your learning. You have to be in charge of your path. You have to sort of pick up something that you're passionate about, and you may not know what that is. So you'll have to experiment a bit. And this is one of the things that I try to bring into my classes is to hopefully help find students that passion for learning through unstructured problem solving. Because the rest of their career, you're never going to be given a problem with here are 10 steps that you have to do. So it'd be never stop learning. The challenges just get bigger. And, you know, as part of the mentoring that I do is the more you want to climb up the ladder, the less and less direction you get and more ambiguous the problems get.
Right. And that's not always a popular message to the students when you say that.
Not at all. And I was, as I'm preparing for our classes here that start in a couple of weeks, I'm taking an entire class to just talk about that. Because as I'm now working in a different capacity and in a different consultancy, that's all it is. It's unstructured problem solving. And at least for me, that's exciting. But there's going to be a point in your career that you're going to want to pivot, and some of the skills that we're trying to instill in the students today that may seem hard or unusual or inconvenient are those very skills that's going to help them be successful in the years to come.
That's awesome. I think we'll leave it there. Appreciate you, sir. We'll see you soon.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Cheers.
This podcast has been a production of the Gonzaga University School of Business. It was edited by yours truly, Margie Allgaard. Go forth and set the world.